All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everybody. It is 44 degrees and beautifully sunny here in upstate New York. Looks like the rain has stopped. It's a little crispy, but it's pretty nice out in the sunshine. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show, The Internet of Things, Mad Science Shaping Evolution, and Biohacker CEO Cures Aging. Oh, yesterday was a hard one to name. I after 288 shows on YouTube about this stuff, it gets hard to come up with new things. I think I'm a little obsessed with this stuff. Anyway, so we spent some time the last couple days looking at smart dust. We went back to the very beginnings, back in the 90s when they were tinkering with this stuff in the lab with the vision of having smart motes everywhere. And after the show, I did a little bit of digging to see what I could find. And I had mentioned these memristors one time that Joe Friday in chat had dropped me a story about back like 6 months ago or so, where the little memristor, which is what they're making the smart dust out of, but the memristor in this story had little legs like a mech warrior. And I found a research document out of UC Berkeley. All the references were back from the early 90s, though the document itself wasn't dated. It appears that it was some early research being done at Berkeley that was exactly where they were developing smart dust. And remember, HP was in Palo Alto, California, and they were the ones that I remember in the 90s working on smart dust. And they are also the ones who now want to make the central nervous system for the planet as they release trillions of sensors. But I found in that early research back in the 90s in that that document from UC Berkeley that they had already come up with locomotion for smart dust, where they could literally put two little legs on it where they could bobble back and forth and have motor function forward and backward. So it's kind of scary. It's in the notes, actually, of yesterday's show titled Micro Robot Leg Design for Smart Dust. So not only could you potentially have smart dust all over the planet with trillions of sensors released, but they might have legs too. All right. So where are we going to continue? We went on, we talked about Craig Venter and his synthetic biology launches. He is already working on next generation with some significant hurdles that they had been coming up against solved. And then last but not least, and I want to get back to this because this is absolute insanity. This is not the first time that we have heard of a scientist saying screw the FDA and putting themselves in harm's way because it's all about that dangling carrot, people, and injecting themselves or using themselves as the guinea pig for some new mad science gone mad. I wanted to play that clip. I don't know if I have it up now even, but there was a clip I had queued up from the other day about the Russian scientist who injected himself with a 3.5 million year old bacteria that he had found because he said it held the fountain of youth. And of course it's all about now living forever. That's kind of like the big money push. Any of us, and people just don't realize that it's been like thousands of years that they've been looking for the fountain of youth, quote unquote. And I mean, though it is probably closer than ever, I don't know about you, but I keep my greed in check. And I would not be injecting myself with some new freaky stem cell that'll go in and make changes in my body just so I could win the Cupidel. It's ridiculous. So let's read about this chick. Gene therapy makes BioViva, so that is the name of the new company, BioViva CEO Elizabeth Parrish, younger, blunter, and resolute. We talked to the woman who claims to have reversed the aging process, and she is ready for a revolution. Elizabeth Parrish, Chief Executive Officer and guinea pig for BioViva, announced today, and this was April 22nd of 2016, that she has become the first human successfully rejuvenated by gene therapy. Now, true, they're doing all kinds of new gene therapies. I saw that they were working on HIV, and I don't know, there's some research that's showing that every time they try to edit HIV out, they can't. But then the Chinese are trying to genetically modify embryos so they can't ever get infected with HIV, so who knows. And which one did I just see? Well, they were working on some reversal of autism using some sort of genetic process. And then there was just one this morning I saw now that they're talking about working on. But the thing is remember, to get the ability to experiment, you need to be able to prove that it works. And they're not going to give you a person to be able to experiment on. So typically, it's going to be the desperate, dead, and dying people who have nowhere else to turn. And so your 21st century medicine will be the experimental research cure. Who wants to do that? I don't know too many people, unless, of course, it is the very end. Wow, this is super distracting. Somebody's got a massive chipper shredder that must be going around my street, but it sounds like they're shredding. I don't know. I hope you can't hear that. Oh, all right. Anyway, let's read this story. So she successfully became the first human rejuvenated by gene therapy, and using two proprietary processes, Parrish claims to have reversed two decades worth of telomere shortening, the process that leads to the breakdown of cell replication in a vast majority of things. Telomere scores measuring white blood cells indicate that Parrish, who was 44 years old in September, has slowed her cellular processes that many scientists believe to be the root cause of aging. Now, I've done research into telomeres before, and staying up late, smoking cigarettes, not getting enough sleep, that type of thing. Living a rough life tends to shorten your telomeres, so I don't know about you, but I think I'd really hate to see the length of mine. This makes a big day for Elizabeth Parrish. She publicly announced a potential cure for the disease she feared would kill her. Time. And Parrish has become one of the leading lights of the biohacking movement by refusing to see aging as a fundamental fact of life. She has described her highly experimental gene and cellular therapies as treatments targeted against an epidemic sometimes called the silver tsunami. And she has made it very clear that to her, old is a diagnosis. And what she hasn't always made clear, and it seems to actively avoid addressing, are the moral, societal, and even medical ramifications of her work, as well as the science. Earlier this week, she spoke to Inverse, and that is this publication that I'm reading from right now, about becoming her own patient zero, and how human cells are like computers, which we just read about that, how they now have this new programming language that they can utilize with CRISPR that's just like building an application. And she also talks about why she is justified in evading the FDA. What made you realize that aging was a disease and not a normal process? And like I joked about yesterday, it wasn't that she had a conversation with Ray Kurzweil. She says, I had actually gotten involved to cure childhood disease, so I wasn't exactly entirely prepared to find out that the biological aging was, in fact, a disease. And I went to a very crucial conference that changed my mind in England. It's called the SENS Conference in Cambridge, UK, and I became very interested in this idea that perhaps biological aging itself was a disease. I took the time to speak with many researchers after that, and I found out that some of the drivers of childhood disease were, in fact, accelerated aging. I basically had to change my thinking to realize that the body's cells are very much like a computer and that the things that they're programmed to do eventually land up with a lot of damage over time. Some people get that damage at a youthful age. That is, some people have programming issues. Yes, like I mentioned, we're all going to be defective in the future. You know, as they get to bag and tag and slice and dice us to the point where they could tell what biological function is going on at what moment and what time and what cell, they'll be able to identify all of our programming glitches. And some of us may not be repairable. We could be called damaged goods and put in that pile over there for future research. Because we don't have the proper genes. You know, we drank and smoked too much and had too much stress growing up. So our telomeres are all shortened and we have breaks in our DNA chain or defective processes going on in our brain. It's very upsetting to me as we follow all of this research on a daily basis, and every day there's more. I mean, I just, before the show, I started scrolling for the last half hour and I just get so sucked in. And then I'm like, oh no, the show's in 2 minutes. And I gotta like get back to where we were a couple days ago when I first found the research, because there's so much to keep up with. I really am having a lot of difficulty. It's moving faster than we can even read it. Anyway, back to this woman. So she has absolutely discovered that the body cells are like a programming language. And you know, DNA, CATG, they've already found ways to mess with CATG and build biological applications, I guess you would call them, where a 0 and a 1 for the digital, you have, instead of 2 variables, you now have 4 with CATG. And they've been messing with that, being able to map from the digital to the biological. And we looked at a lot of that back when we were doing the brain implants and things. There's been a lot of research going into that. And maybe we'll get back into, by the end of the week, some Zoltan Istvan, the self-declared head of the transhumanist movement. I have subscribed to Zoltan. He's been a guest, I think once, maybe twice. Once, I believe, on UCY, Michael Cross's show, Unlock the Door. And I subscribed to Zoltan, and he's got some pretty interesting ideas. I mean, he's not a bad guy, and he doesn't want everyone to be merged with the machine necessarily. You know, make that decision yourself. But he at least has some morals. He has been putting out some stories that kind of look at both sides of the good and the bad, and how, you know, if robots take all the jobs, what's this universal basic income going to do to everybody, and what's it going to do to the economy? And I like that. At least he's smart, and he's got half a brain, and he's not just going full steam ahead like some of these lunatics injecting themselves with stuff to, you know, win the booby prize. I just don't understand where this complete blind psychopathic drive to win, because there's going to be such a huge payoff in the end for the people who discover it. I don't see how you could risk life and limb for that type of payoff. I wouldn't. How greedy are you? I guess is that was what it lays out. How greedy are you? And what would you do for a dollar? Would you chuck your mother off a bridge? Because I bet this chick would. If you can inject yourself with something that's that unknown, call yourself a biohacker, do something that's not FDA approved, not that that does anything. There's lots of people who die on things that were rubber stamped through the FDA, and nobody's really looking at anything anyway, because they're just butt patting and slippery, sliming money. But I at least would want some sort of approval on something before I even considered utilizing it as a therapy. And I'm sure that this woman, being a scientist, is pretty certain of herself. But I wouldn't be the first guinea pig. You never, ever, ever, ever. There isn't something that you learn from Microsoft. Never, ever, ever be a 1.0. All right, anyway, back to this. Some people get that damage at a youthful age. That is, some people have programming issues, genetic problems early on, and then some people are born with them. But all of us are accumulating this damage that will eventually lead to symptoms of the aging disease and kill us. The problem, she thought, would be much easier to solve, and it was actually everyone's problem. It wasn't an orphan disease. It wasn't a small subset of children. It's actually everyone who has this disease. And it's inherent in our very selves. And at that point, she was very mobilized. And in a sense, it was a bigger problem, but it seemed easier to solve. So he thought that one of the most important things that we needed to do was to start collecting human data. It seemed to be what we were lacking. We were sitting on all sorts of mouse data for a slew of diseases that actually looked really good. And I think we've cured cancers 100 times in mice, and we've reversed arteriolosis plaques, and we've reversed biological aging with telomerase inducers, but we weren't using it in humans. So in order to get the safety data, I decided I would get behind them, and I would prove that they were safe by taking them. So I am patient zero, she says. The interviewer says, last year you went to Columbia to undergo the first round of your BioViva gene treatment therapy, and that was a huge risk. She says, but living is very risky, yes. We could get hit by a car tomorrow, run over by a bus, and you are guaranteed to die of these diseases, that disease called aging. And if we could start using these methods in end-stage patients, hello, ding, ding, the dead and dying and desperate. You know, the ethical conundrum here just really bothers me, because at some point we're all going to be in that boat, whether it be us or a loved one, where somebody is in really bad shape, and we're going to have to make some really tough decisions. And I mean, I've been there before. That's not a good place to be. And you're not always thinking clearly, and the only thing that you want to do is to save whatever person or creature that is. And most of the time you're helpless, because there's nothing you can do about it. And then some glowing entity walks into the room with a key in their hand and says, I have this experimental treatment. And there's no guarantees, but it's the best chance you got. What do you do? What do you do? And most times, I would say 99.99% of the time, the insurance company will not cover experimental treatments. So a lot of the times you're going to be paying through the nose, but a lot of the times, just like in the tech industry, because they're trying to get the data to be able to get approval for whatever new procedure or drug that they're trying out on the desperate and dying, a lot of times you might just become a case study. A lot of times you might just be one of the lucky few that are dubbed as being a part of the quote-unquote research. But what would you do in that case? So like she says, if we can start using these methods in end-stage patients, and I'm going to guarantee you that probably the majority of us, if it were the end and it was us or someone that we loved, we might actually step right up and give it the last roll of the dice to see whether or not we get snake eyes. Patients for compassionate care scenarios, and we are starting to get good results. We can move them back into patients who are not in such critical shape. And then we can move them back to preventative medicine, and then we really have something happening. So we start in the dead and dying, and if we start getting good results, then we can go to the patients who are in the decline. And if we get good results there, then we can take it to precision preventative 21st century medicine as a therapy. And then we'll be making all kinds of money. We'll have cost-saving measures, right? Because, hey, if we can cure aging, then nobody will get sick anymore. Healthcare will be a thing of the past. We'll put nanobots in your blood, and everything will be hunky-dory. And we'll actually be saving lives before people get sick. Me? You're asking how I'm feeling after my treatment? I'm feeling great. and we will be releasing some data on that sooner rather than later. Why? So the interviewer says, why do you think there have been so many obstacles to human testing for anti-aging gene therapy? Well, the obstacles are in the regulatory framework. Remember, we've talked about that before. Damn that FDA keeping these 21st century cures away from the people, because there are people who are dying right now and they are making certain that the speed at which innovation moves in healthcare is too slow, right? They have that 21st Century Cures Act in front of Congress that wants to get rid of all of the mumbo jumbo and get these experimental cures in the hands of the people. Now guys, again, I talked about this long time ago, the day when things shifted from having an R&D line item budget for Big Pharma and I don't even know what you'd call them now. It's beyond Big Pharma. This is medical industrial complex. They don't need an R&D line item budget anymore for thousands of millions of trillions of dollars, because if they get rid of this approval process and allow them to test it in sick patients, they don't have to pay to do that in the lab anymore. It's real time. R&D, erase that line item. The shareholders are happy. And look, everybody wins. And hey, if Aunt Susie doesn't quite make it, at least you gave her a chance that she wasn't going to have before, right? Actually, let's see if we could do this. I don't know. I'm going to see if I can connect to myself, because we haven't done this one in a while. But there was a video that came out back last summer. Now, hopefully, I don't have audio on. I don't know. There's so many windows open. We'll find out. There we go. All right, there was a video that came out last June. I think we watched it. And it's only a couple minutes. But let's get the volume cranked up. It is with two. There we go. I don't know if I can find the one with two of them. But let's see. It should not take the FDA 15 years to approve new drugs. Oh, look, they've removed that video with the congresswoman. Well, here's the congressman. He was the Michigan dude. Now, let's see really quick.
Hello, I'm Yolanda Vasquez, and welcome to Comcast Newsmakers. I am joined now in the studio by Representative Fred Upton of Michigan, Chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. Fred, it is a pleasure to have you here in our studio.
Nice to be here, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit more about the 21st Century Cures Act, which is essentially working to bring healthcare into the 21st century, right? But it's more than that, right?
It's real. So this was major bipartisan legislation that the House passed in mid-July. 344 votes, so across all the spectrum, all across the country. But literally for the last year and a half, our committee has been listening to all the different interest groups on healthcare, patient groups, cancer, diabetes, lupus, Down syndrome, Alzheimer's, researchers, universities, as well as the National Institutes of Health, the FDA, past and present directors.
What do those groups say?
The administration. Well, we wanted to ask them questions. What can we do as legislators to expedite, to advance the approval of drugs and devices? Now, let's use the genome model, something relatively recent, last 15, 20 years. Let's use the advances in science, streamline all the different models for approvals, and let's develop those cures for the diseases here in this country rather than have them go overseas. We learned from venture capitalists, who we also listen to, They've started to invest by 50% change just in the last 5 or 6 years overseas, because that's where they would get the approvals for these drugs and devices rather than here. So by bringing them back to this country, not only are we going to keep the research here and hopefully develop the faster cures for all these things, but when they're actually manufactured, we'll have the jobs here too. So it's a win-win.
Oh, yeah.
Reasons why we were able to get 344 votes in the House. One of the major elements that we also did was to create a new innovation fund, nearly $2 billion a year for the NIH, for them to look to universities and others to research on top of the money already for the NIH.
So just, you know, the National Institute of Health, we've looked at all kinds of different projects that they're involved in, including the Brain Project and also the crazy stuff. I mean, guys, it is like every agency is now lined up and has gotten behind this cash cow that they see glowing in the future. Obama had even said that this new, you know, 21st century medicine is going to be the panacea to bring jobs to our country. He said that again. He's like, God forbid, don't let them go overseas and do research where they don't have laws like ours. All that venture capitalist funding is going over there. No, let's let the mad science, let's let the embryo editing commence. Let's slice and dice genes and see what happens. Because you know what? In the end, after we've made all those mistakes, for the rich people here, it'll be wonderful. But in the meantime, we'll let the taxpayers fund it all.
For 5 years, it's paid for. We came up with what they say in Washington, offsets. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, it's not going to add to the deficit. In fact, it's going to reduce the deficit.
And this money is going to be used for more research?
It is. It's going to be on top of the normal appropriation for spending for the NIH, which is about $31 billion every year, is about what the president asks for and gets from the Congress. So this will be, over the next 5 years, nearly $10 billion. We got more money for the FDA as well. Why?
Jeez.
Because we want them to approve these drugs and devices faster. We want them to use that science, and they're going to need more resources. So, again, they're going to get an increase in their budget as well. So, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, take the case of Alzheimer's. Going unchecked without a cure could cost Medicare as much as $1 trillion by the year 2050. So think if we find a cure. You know, my uncle had polio. Thank goodness
we don't hear about it.
Yeah, they probably gave him polio like my dad's cousin when he got the vaccination. You know, interesting he mentions Alzheimer's, though, right? We've dug deep into that. It all started with brain research in DARPA's end and putting in little implants to treat soldiers who, you know, have dopamine deficiencies or PTSD. And all of a sudden, oh, now we can do all this Alzheimer's research. We can put little nano particles in the brain and use ultrasound. And what was the new one? The Stentrode. What else? You know, I just don't even know what to say about any of this anymore. I don't want any part of it. I want none of it. Absolutely none of it. This is to suck us all in. And honestly, people, anybody who has starry eyes thinking that this is going to allow them to live forever really should get off the high horse, because I don't think we're meant to live forever.
That's right. Yeah. We got a cure for it, and it saves hundreds of millions of dollars of what otherwise had to be used for the iron lungs and all those different things. Yeah. So if we can find one cure for any of these diseases, Parkinson's, MS,
make
cancer.
Make all the difference in the world.
Oh,
and, only got about 30 right. seconds left. The House passed the bill earlier this year. What's going on in the Senate?
Senate is starting to react, as they should. We've been in discussions with them really from the beginning of the year. Lamar Alexander, Patty Murray, Republican, Democrat, working together. We're hoping that they can come up with a with the package that we can go to conference on, work it out, get it to the president before the end of the year.
Sounds like you've got a lot of work ahead of you, but already some work that's been done.
All right. Well, I don't want to talk about her anymore. So what do you think of that? He was, I think there was a senator from Michigan. What is his name? He's from the House of Representatives, Fred Upton from Michigan. And yeah, then there's a woman too. And while he was talking, I actually saw that original video called The Path to 21st Century Cures. And maybe toward the end of the show, if we have a few minutes, I can put that on because it's pretty disturbing the way they go through it, and they just show you how they're going to fast track everything. And let's not go through the approvals. Let's write case studies on everyone and give it to the dead and dying. See what happens, because whoops, it don't really matter if they die anyway. But in the meantime, we'll get some real-time human research, and maybe you should give it up for the good of all. Sacrifice yourself to help everybody by being the first ones to try this potentially dangerous therapy that we want to put into you. So anyway, do you think there have been so many obstacles to human testing for anti-aging gene therapy? And she says the obstacles are in the regulatory framework. At this point, it is not really starting a fight to say that the US FDA and other countries have stifled innovation. That's just obvious, she says. It's just too much paperwork. It's just too far-reaching. The cost to get it through the US FDA is way too high, and there is no reason at this point that we have to mix safety and efficacy with a price tag of over $1 billion. Those two don't need to go together. We need to find out how to efficiently get therapeutics through to the public that might be life-saving. It's just amazing, though, because if it takes that much time and effort and money to get things approved through the FDA, and we still end up with fraudulent research, and we still end up with drugs that kill people accidentally, whoops, how is that even possible? So what's it going to be like if we just get rid of all the regulatory agencies, get rid of all the testing, get rid of all the approval, all the paperwork, and just let it go direct to laboratory to sick person? How do you think that's going to work out? I don't know why these people think that it's just going to be so much better, especially if they absolve, with it being experimental, it absolutely would be. If they would absolve them of any and all lawsuits ever, this would be like a free-for-all, free billions and billions of dollars of research and development. And like she said, look, it was a price tag of over $1 billion. So you know right then and there, $1 billion, R&D, whoop, gone. And every one of these mad science companies will be a lot richer for him. So anyway, she says, here at home, we just cannot move quickly enough for patients. Yes, those poor patients. And we are losing over 100,000 people a day to biological aging. We're not really treating this like the catastrophe that it is. Ebola came up and killed many people, and that's a big tragedy, but it didn't kill anywhere near the number of people who die every month of biological aging. Can you believe this? So now be afraid, be very afraid of getting old. Like that wasn't ever a fact of life. I mean, yeah, I agree. Getting old sucks. Would I want to slow it down a little bit? Maybe. I'd rather have a skinny pill that didn't take a lot of effort and maybe a stay red hair pill. But I don't know. I don't know. What's going to happen when everybody doesn't get old anymore? You know, they're crying now. We got too many people on this planet. We can't maintain all the resources because of all the people on this planet. So let's just extend everybody's lives. You know, the only reason that they're going to do this is because they right now have a huge number of guinea pigs who might jump on this bandwagon and beta test it all out. So it'll be ready for prime time. Once the big catastrophe happens, most of us are gone, and the rich people finally want to start popping their biologics that make them live forever. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that if we're in such dire straits right now, we'd be talking about extending everybody's lives indefinitely, right? There's no such thing as a free lunch here, Mousy Mousy. All right. As a matter of fact, if you start looking at that and extrapolate the numbers, millions of people are dying in the next matter of months. And if we just think of this process as being very normal, it's actually a very costly process, and it's going to hinder our future significantly. The silver tsunami has already hit the industrialized countries, and it is about to hit the whole earth. Well, damn good thing that everybody's working on entire armies of industrialized robots then, since we have the entire population aging and they won't have enough people to fill the jobs. All right, so this interviewer says, how are you convinced the FDA that investing in it now is a better idea than paying for it later? Well, on Earth by 2020, just a mere 4 years, there will be more people over 65 than under 5 years of age. And so the five-year-olds become five, then 25, then 35, then they become the workforce, while the 65-year-olds are retired and are in imminent danger of 20, 30, and 40 years of needed accelerated health care. And oh my God, and that is going to cost us so much, even in a socialized medicine world, which is why we need telemedicine and nanobots in your blood. Do you see how they're going to play this all out? But it's the medical mafia that has merged with the military-industrial complex to become a part of the entire surveillance grid. It isn't about keeping you healthy or safe. It's about monitoring and using you as a guinea pig to do all their mad science research for free. Since we're actually at a point where it's just not fashionable. And it's not a vanity issue. It's a how do we save economies? How do we keep people working longer? And how do we save trillions of dollars that we spend every 4 years on major diseases, which have led to no cures? The government, your employer, you, everyone saves so much money by mitigating these diseases that there is no reason to hold this type of technology back. But if this actually happens, is everyone going to have equal access to these types of therapies? Well, yes, absolutely, she says. Of course she does. It's going to happen very similar to computers and cell phones as well. And the first technology is very expensive because it's new. Ray Kurzweil said these very words yesterday about the cell phone, as a matter of fact. First of its kind, like building a supercomputer, and then eventually everyone gets an iPhone. In your life, when you look at that, you don't ever remember living without an iPhone. Well, I do, because I don't have an iPhone. But certainly, you like an iPhone better than you would have liked it if you had to pay for the first supercomputer, because your iPhone is much more predictable than the supercomputer was. But that is the model. And we will get there as quickly as we can drive down the cost so that everyone has access to the new mad science. So are we going to have a shift in the retirement age then? What's the limit there? Well, I don't really get asked these kinds of questions, she says. My job is to mitigate the diseases we can mitigate and to create the mandate. Did she just see this? To create the mandate on Earth. She's creating a mandate on Earth that the minute we do that, we have to move forward. So she wants to create the mandate that when she mitigates diseases, we have to move forward. And if we think we have something, it would be immoral to not move forward with it. How long can people live? I don't know, but I want them to live as well and as healthy as they can and live for as long as possible. And that is good for society. That is good for the economy. That is good for you and me. And that is good for the future of our planet, except for the climate changers. But won't you run into a problem finding people willing to take part in your studies if they are so experimental? Ding, ding, ding. Well, yes. We have no end of volunteers, though, and they are both healthy and sick. And as a reminder, yeah, the healthy ones are the transhumanists. As a reminder, as far as the FDA is concerned, in the past 50 years, they have passed through their gold standards 50 drugs that have since been pulled from the market. And some of those drugs were actually harmful, if not fatal, to patients. So we cannot pretend that their standards have kept anyone safe. And, you know, I mean, that's the big question that I have. But if it's taken so much research, time, effort, and money to get all these things approved, how did these drugs that cause severe damage end up on the market? Was it because they totally missed something and they were butt-patting and sliding money around that there really wasn't due diligence done? Or was it that we just don't know, and this technology and messing with brain chemicals and bodily chemicals and intervening with drugs and procedures or whatever is just so complex, and we only understand the tiniest drop in the bucket of the way everything works together in our global ecosystem, between the ecosystems within our bodies that every day we discover more and more, between how bacteria live in our gut and affect our brain especially, and that type of thing. And when you kill one, you might break something else. You know, or is it that they just look the other way and let something go that shouldn't have been approved? So who knows? But I'm saying somebody's got to be looking at this stuff before it gets rubber stamped for the unsuspecting or the overly zealous or the sick and dying to get involved. I just don't think that it's called predatory. You know, people just aren't bright enough to think through situations from start to finish. And if you offer some, you know, new revolutionary way of treating something, I was a guinea pig of the medical industry for 20 plus odd years with all kinds of strange health problems. And they always had some new thing you wanted to try that was just approved here. This will fix you. And, you know, here I am years later, and it's like, oh, look, they don't use that procedure anymore because it caused damage. Oh, look, anyone who did this ended up with salivary cancer, and they don't do that anymore either. You know, I mean, it just, it's very bothersome to me that we are raised to believe that the medical establishment has all the answers, and they don't. They're just guessing, just like everybody else. Try it 100 different ways till you find something that works. And then you got to sit around and wait for 10 years to see how stable it is. So anyway, in the past 50 years, through their gold standards, they've passed 50 drugs that have been pulled from the market. And some of those drugs were actually harmful, if not fatal, to patients. And we cannot pretend that their standard has kept anyone safe. And it was there initially to keep people safe, but it is not actually doing a good job of that. It definitely serves a purpose where we want drugs with safety and efficacy. We want to keep the public safe, but not to the point of where they're dying waiting for treatment. Well, then you go to the VA for that. That wasn't even funny. And if you let people die without access to experimental treatments, then your safety and efficacy administration is failing. So, another big push to get mad science gone mad on the fast track so all of us can have access to it, and it can be democratized just like all the other mad science. Here, I want to play this now.
Well, hello there. I'm Fred Upton.
And I'm Diana DeGette.
And I'm a Republican from Michigan.
And I'm a Democrat from Colorado.
You know, we know that you've probably heard a lot about the gridlock, dysfunction, and division in Congress, for sure.
It's true. We do have our differences. Fred and I don't agree on everything, but we do agree on this. America can be, it must be, the healthcare innovation capital of the world.
You know, you may not realize it, but together, we have already accomplished a lot to improve public health with a whole number of bills supporting medical research enacted over the last couple of years. I'm also proud to say that I helped lead the charge back in the 1990s, bipartisan effort, to double the funding of the National Institutes of Health.
This is a good start, but now it's time to go bigger.
You know, in the 21st century, healthcare innovation is happening at lightning speed. From the mapping of the human genome to the risk of personalized medicines that are linked to advances in molecular medicine, we've seen constant breakthroughs that are changing the face of disease treatment, management, and certainly cures.
And now we want you and your children, and Nana, of course, to be on the forefront of these amazing breakthroughs and utilize them in curing you. Wink.
Health research is moving quickly, but the federal drug and device approval apparatus is still, in many ways, the relic of another era. We have dedicated scientists and bold leaders at agencies like the NIH and the FDA. But when our laws don't keep pace with innovation, we all lose out.
So if we want to save more lives, and we do, and keep the country the leader in medical innovation and the jobs here, we've got to make sure that there's not a major gap between the science of cures in the way that we actually regulate these therapies.
That's why, for the first time ever, we in Congress are going to take a comprehensive look at what steps we can take to accelerate the pace of cures in America. We're looking at the full arc of this process, from the discovery of clues in basic science, to streamlining the drug and device development process, to unleashing the power of digital medicine and social media at the treatment delivery phase.
Yeah, and let's try and convince everyone how wonderful it is. You know what is so disturbing about all of this is we've dug into who is responsible for these quote-unquote 21st century cures, and we found that the majority of them have either happened from sprinkle funding that has come from DARPA or tech billionaires who want to live forever funding startups. Now, really, do we want those people using us and our children and our family members as guinea pigs for free to further research that then in the end are not going to help the common people? This, you know, they really are trying to sell this, that it's going to help everybody and we're all going to win. Just give yourself up to be one of the, you know, one of the people who go down in the history books as helping humanity by becoming one of the first people to get nanobots in your blood. I mean, I just, there are so many people that I've spoken to that are all for this. Yeah, they're going to cure cancer. Whoa, it's so great. Don't get in line. Don't.
You know, all of that is so exciting, but we know that we don't have all the answers. That's why we're asking questions first. We want to listen, and we are. We want to know how to close the gaps between advances in scientific knowledge about cures and the regulatory policies that are created to save more lives.
How can we make sure our best scientists spend more of their time in the laboratory discovering cures rather than just writing grant proposals?
And how can we foster even more collaboration using new technological resources like cloud computing or social media?
You know what's messed up is I haven't heard this video in quite a long time, but her thing that she was just saying about keeping the scientists in the lab instead of writing grant proposals, I just read those very exact same words in some article that we were doing the other day, and it seems to me like they must have a script that they are just all spewing the same message to try and sell everybody on this.
Are there new ways to improve the process of developing and approving new drugs and devices?
You know, our understanding of disease at the genetic level can certainly help reduce the cost and quicken the pace of clinical trials. That means patients potentially have faster access to those treatments. What do we need to make this happen?
To keep things moving and constantly improving, we must then capture the impact of these new drugs and devices and share that data with researchers, caregivers, and patients.
Working together, that'll ensure that the discovery process continues to move forward, constantly improving and learning.
And by this collaborative effort, asking these important questions and constantly challenging ourselves to always be doing more and doing better, we can put America on a swift trajectory to make the predominant diseases of today a thing of the past.
Yeah. First discovery, then development, then delivery, and back again to discovery. We must never cease. Our efforts for 21st century cures is now underway.
Yeah, and look out, everybody, because it's going to assimilate us all. All right, so let's take a look at 21st century cures, and we want to keep our innovation in our country, and so let's get rid of all the regulatory agencies so we can unleash this quickly. We could hype it in social media and then build a demand and roll it out to the population to see how it performs. Well, gene editing research in human embryos has now gained momentum, and guess what? It's not happening in the United States. Damn them. Originally, we had read about China, not once but twice now, editing human genomes. But guess what? Experiments are now approved also in Sweden, China, and the UK. This is from a few days ago, April 19th, at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Frederick Lanner is preparing to edit genes in the human embryo. Brave new world coming soon. It is the kind of research that has sparked an international frenzy in April last year when a Chinese team revealed that it had done the world's first such experiments. And remember, yeah, they revealed it, but I can guarantee you it's probably going on behind closed doors, and it has been for a very long time. But Lanner doesn't expect his work, which will explore early human development, to cause such a fuss. A year of discussion about the ethics of embryo editing research, and perhaps simply the passage of time, seems to have blunted its controversial edge. Yeah, well, guess what? Everybody has now become used to it. They've been desensitized, and now it's not going to cause such a stir because they've pushed this into everybody's vision, and it's too hard for people to understand. They're like, yeah, well, okay, from the most simplistic ways, they'll just find ways to fix us or make us better, and let's not think about anything else. Let's not think about the implications to the planet Earth or to the future of biology 1.0 or what it's going to do to us in evolutionary terms in the next generation or so. We're already seeing that. We're already seeing just how our interaction with the machine, our interaction with computers have changed us from a society who were motivated, physical. We built things. We were industrial, to ones that are couch potatoes, that are addicted to our devices and sit and drool as we wait for the machine to tell us what to do because we can no longer think for ourselves. That has happened in a very short period of time. Anyway, so it seems to have blunted its controversial edge, although such work remains subject to the same ethical anxieties that surround other reproductive biology experiments. Quote, at least in the scientific community, I sense more support for basic research applications, says Lanner. His instinct seems to be born out of the fairly muted reaction to an April 6th report of an experiment to edit human embryos, only the second to be published. And that was the one that I was talking about, the second one in China, about trying to edit out HIV or make the embryo impervious to ever getting HIV. A team led by Yang Fang at Guangzhou Medical University in China used the gene editing technology, ding, 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 a CupiDal, to anyone who can spell it, CRISPR-Cas9, to introduce a mutation that makes humans resistant to HIV infection. I don't think that there is anything wrong with what these scientists have done, says Sarah Chan, a bioethicist at the University of Edinburgh in the UK. This work isn't seeking to do what is still ethically in question. It is not seeking to create genetically modified human beings. Well, not yet, it's not. But if you're doing experiments in the lab, eventually that will be the end result. And by the way, yes, it's not seeking to create genetically modified human beings that we know of. Don't forget that China has built that genetic, I don't know if you call it genetic modification factory, but it absolutely was being called a clone factory to be able to clone 100,000 cattle a month, I believe. And the owner of that facility said that it is also set up to be able to do humans. So who knows what is actually being worked on behind closed doors. The ethics committee of the university-affiliated hospital that approved Fan's work says that it has green-lighted two other embryo editing projects. Such research is ethically sound because it will lead to improvements in gene editing technology and it can help prevent diseases, says the committee spokesperson. Last December, an international summit of scientists and ethicists declared that gene editing should not be done in a human embryo that is intended for use in establishing a pregnancy, but it endorsed basic research. People are more understanding of this research, says Fan, who points to the UK fertility regulator's approval in February of a proposal by developmental biologist Kathy Nikand to edit genes in healthy human embryos. Now, how are they getting around the religious brouhaha with this? If they're editing healthy embryos, then have those embryos not already somehow been fertilized to be considered life? I don't know. How is this any different than stem cell research that caused all the ruckus back in the 80s? FAN's team began its experiments in early 2014 and originally submitted a paper to Stem Cell, FAN says. And by the time the manuscript ended up on the desk of David Albertini, editor-in-chief of the Assisted Reproduction and Genetics, a different Zhenghu's based team had already become the first to report human embryo editing experiments. And that paper, which tried to correct a mutation that caused a blood disease, fed into a firestorm over the ethics of modifying human reproductive cells or germline modification. Some researchers call for a moratorium, including the creator of CRISPR-Cas9, Jennifer Doudna, even on proof of principle research in non-viable embryos. And one of the reasons why they're calling for a moratorium is because as they start slicing and dicing the embryo, they're pointing out the fact that these genetic mutations that they will be introducing at some point in the future, if these embryos ever reproduce, will change the course of evolution for all of biology on planet Earth. And even more interesting, this Albertini is a reproductive biologist at where? Oh, the University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City. And everybody would go, well, what's the big deal with that? But guess what moved to the University of Kansas? Oh, right. Manhattan, Kansas. The good old Plum Island 2.0 is moving right there. So how awesome is that? And I guess last but not least, and maybe we can finish up the story tomorrow, but I found something interesting right at the end of the evening last night out of Science Magazine and The Telegraph. Bright flash of light marks incredible moment. Life begins when sperm meets egg, and they caught it on film. It goes poof, let there be light. All right, guys, have an awesome Wednesday, and I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody take care.